南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Hello, everyone. I hope this finds you in good health and secure. In that regard, I greatly appreciate your being here, spending some time with your study, your practice. That's what this is all about, keeping ourselves engaged in actively remaining in Buddhaness, keeping our Buddha mind constantly active as we course through the day. It's really easy when we're sitting in front of our butsudan, using our perfect mandala mirror of our gohonzon, our open door to Buddhaness in our minds. We do it instantaneously, and we can maintain it as long as we're chanting, doing gongyo. But the moment we close up shop, if you will, and walk into our daily life, it starts to diminish, doesn't it? It starts to slip away, that bodily sensation, that mental equanimity. It just, oh yeah, I gotta do this. Oh yeah, I gotta go to work. Oh yeah, I'm gonna see that person. Oh yeah, all of our daily attachments, right? They start to flood back in. But fear not, whether you're aware or not, if your practice is consistent, even though that occurs, within your mind, you're sorting, evaluating, perceptive mind, your epistemology is being modified just from the time you spend instantiating your Buddhaness. And epistemology isn't something we're consciously aware of, is it? It's the way we build our thoughts and what our thoughts are built upon. Well, that, you could say the alaya consciousness, it's being influenced, it's being modified by virtue of our practice. And it is affecting the way we experience those very same samsaric things. The real world, yes? The real being the physical, material world, yeah? So it's different even if you don't know it. Most of the time, we begin to become aware of how affected our life is by that epistemological shift, by reading our environment differently, by realizing over time, hey, you know, that's not happening. It's been a long time since. That's a subtle way of recognizing that karma, the alaya consciousness, the freight train of energy that is us, you and me, it's being modified. You're doing it. The other way, of course, is when things occur in your life and you go, wow, I didn't see that coming. Or wow, I've always wondered about that, but here it is. Or you catch yourself in an activity, you go, how did I get here? This is unusual. This is unexpected, right? Those surprises usually really life-affirming. And instead of going, ah, and losing your mind, you become aware, wow, I've actually brought myself here through my Buddhaness. This isn't just some gift from mana or whatever. It's something I've created. And the possibility for this, the potential for this, has always been there. I'm just finally tapping into it. This is the nature of what I've been talking about recently about happiness, real happiness. It's not material. It's this experience of life that we don't even know we're capable of having. That alone should be motivation to continue your practice, yeah? All right. Shakyamuni is still trying to impress upon Mahamati that the answer isn't in his possessions, words or otherwise. Or as Richie pointed out, in the treasures of the Middle East. Those of you who are on Patreon will have a clue what that's about. So let's continue and let's see how profound Mr. Siddhartha Gautama in his enlightened form as Shakyamuni. Once again, Shakyamuni is a compound word for those of you who haven't heard that before. Shakyamuni isn't his name as a human. It's his appellation, his name, as given to him, Muni being a great sage, and Shakya being identifying that he's from a lineage or a clan, the Shakya. So he's the great sage of the Shakya clan, Shakya Muni. I didn't know that until well into my practice. Not that it's that important, but it helps to understand that when he spoke on Buddha, he wasn't talking about himself. He was talking about his experience of life through tapping into this maximal potential and trying to get everyone else to realize how they too could do the same thing. But materialistic as we tend to be, he was identified as the Buddha. Something accessible and constantly inherent in our very existence. It's a bit of a conundrum, right? Fighting our identification of things versus our being. Just that. A sentient mind, not a body. This is great, having this body, but only because it manifests this emergent quality, mind. All right. At that time, Mahamati, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, said to the emancipated one, Impermanence. This is the discrimination of the philosophers. And you too declare in the canonical texts, now he's referring to the earlier teachings, right? That all composite things are impermanent. In other words, all constructed things, right? The language of Buddhism. They're impermanent. They're ephemeral. To be subject to birth and destruction is the nature of things. Not so much the nature of things. The concept in the human mind, the samsaric, I should say, mind, is this identification, right? So the birth of something is because it's birthed in the mind as a thing in and of itself. And as that is a constructed thought about the thing, right? Go look at the fountain analogy if I'm losing you here, right? That search in the middle of the homepage of this channel, a little magnifying glass, the fountain analogy, boom, you'll get those videos. that experience, that logged experience of the thing, says nothing about the thing. Right? Buddhism repeats this constantly. Just because you put a label on it doesn't mean that's what that is. That is a label you've applied in your mind to describe your experience, which is uniquely yours, of something. But as Shakyamuni points out, everything is in process. Everything is moving through time-space. Everything is a moment-to-moment instantiation of suchness. That thing has the characteristics of, and we define what really is, action, not a static thing. But this is the slippery slope. Because as soon as we put a label on it and call it something, we now possess it. We possess it through a mentation of identification. That is my chair. Even if we don't say my. Even if we go into an auditorium and go, wow, look at all the chairs in here. We are in our way, in our minds, possessing the identity of all of those chairs. Rather, we should be, if at all, impressed that there's a lot of chairness going on in here. Wow, how amazing. It's happening, not happened. Not because I've identified it, boom. If you think about it, it's almost like killing off everything we identify. We fossilize it in our minds. Follow? So he's making reference to this without really understanding what he's saying is the reason I'm pointing this out. In the canonical texts, he says that all composite things are impermanent. Now, the operative word composite is a mentation, is in the mind it's constructed. But I suspect he collates that composite to be an actual construction in the physical world rather than the mind. That might be a clue. To be subject to birth and destruction is the nature of things. See, he's putting these characteristics upon the things without realizing that those things are not the material world. They are the conjecture in the mind of the world, of the perception of the world. See where language can be deceptive here? So he goes on, but, emancipated one, is this right or wrong? Well, given what I just said, it's both. But in the concept of enlightenment and the consideration for enlightenment, his interpretation is wrong. But how is Shakyamuni going to address this? And how many kinds of impermanency are there? All right, I'll say Mahamati's struggling. But I find his demeanor to be kind of insulting. Let's just say he's struggling. And our compassionate founder, Shakyamuni, is going to respond to him because Mahamati represents students who've been following his teachings for a long time. So of course he wants to lead them to the answers they seek, no matter how frustrating, yeah? So he says, Mahamati, there are 8 kinds of impermanency. Whoa, I didn't see that one coming, did you? As discriminated by the philosophers. Oh. So the materialistically bound thinkers, they've got 8 different kinds of impermanency. Wow, okay. But not by me. I don't hold these views. So maybe he's pointing to Mahamati being confused because he's listening to too many philosophers, yeah? Which includes other sects of Buddhism, right? Earlier sects, based on those very canonical texts that Mahamati is pointing to. Like, he's trying to impugn Shakyamuni's teaching by virtue of his polluted views from these other teachers that Shakyamuni is identifying as philosophers. They're not really Buddhist leaders. They're maintaining all of their scholarship through materialistic views, and that's misleading. All right, eight kinds. Let's hear what they are. And I don't want you to be alarmed, but as I've already pointed out, language is a slippery thing, and you may identify in some of these impermanencies words that I myself have used, and you have used, and you've read in other sutras. But they're going to be defined here to take them apart so we can understand what is meant by those words. Once again, don't get hung up by the words themselves. Try to peer beyond what they seem to be stating, right? And see the intent. Attitude, intent, attitude, intent. I say it all the time, yeah? One, some say that there is origination and then cessation. This is impermanency. That is to say, Mahamati, in the beginning there is something born which ceases to exist. This is impermanency. In other words, it's an empirical statement. Forget the mind versus the physical world. Forget that division, right? Which is what the materialistic mind does. It doesn't consider what the mind is doing on its own. It thinks the mind is just a lens, like an eyeball, that witnesses the real, the physical world, yeah? This is the position of the philosopher and many, many other systems of thought, yeah? Secondly, some explain impermanency as the changing of shape, saying that this chunk of gold can become a bracelet or a jewel or electrical conductor, and because it can change shape, then the nature of gold is impermanence. I don't know. That's malleability. I don't know that it's impermanence. Not a very good example. Three, some say form, right? As in nidana, form. Itself is impermanent. Because everything is mutable, right? Four, some regard impermanency to consist in the changing of form, rupa, saying that it is a continuous, uninterrupted existence of all things that takes place a change in their natural flavor. For instance, milk going through its transformation turns into sour milk and, you know, yogurt and so forth. And that such an invisible decomposition, right? It's kind of magical. Happens to all things. All things rot, ferment, whatever. This is called impermanency. Okay, this is observing change and labeling anything that goes through changes as therefore impermanence. Like there's some permanent property in the physical universe that is impermanent. It's very samsaric thinking, yeah? Some imagine that there is an objective existence, bhava, which is called impermanency. So impermanency for these people is an actual condition of the physical world. Just like color, smell. Sound familiar? The lower worlds, you might be remembering, or realms. Number six, some imagine that existence and non-existence, this is impermanency. That one's a little bit more I don't know if you'd call that intellectual, but it's the proposition that the very fact that things exist or don't exist is like somehow qualified by this fundamental impermanency. Again, it's a made a physical force of some sort. Yeah. 7. Some say that not being born is impermanency. That one's a little tougher to take apart, right? Because of all things being impermanent, and because of impermanency being inherent in them. This is, again, he's referencing another translation from Wei. For the 7th Wei has this: again, there are other philosophers according to whom impermanency consists of not being existent at first, but coming later. So things have to come from somewhere in our physical universe. So that indicates impermanency. And that one eludes me too. The logic in it is a little whooshy, whooshy, smooshy. On an ooshy kick there. Okay. Now, that's 7. Where's the 8th one? Thought he said there were 8. Where's number 8? I guess we'll get to it. Now, Mahamati, he says, by impermanency that exists in existence and non-existence is meant that things made of the elements are by nature subject to destruction and have nothing in them one can take hold of, while the elements themselves are never set in motion. So that's interesting. That is to say that even if you get down to, excuse me, my arthritis. You're witnessing impermanency in the making. So this is to say that everything is made of something else, basically. And at the fundament, once you get to the smallest component, those things are permanent. They're constantly existing. Everything else is just a construct from them in the material world, in the physical world. Yeah. Which is, you know, as a thought experiment, is heading in the right direction. It just has a cold, hard stop at the physical world. Is energy the physical world? There would be a good question to answer in the comments. Hint, hint. By impermanency that is no birth is meant that there is neither permanency nor impermanency, that in all things there is no dualistic evolution of being and non-being, and that nothing is seen to exist, even when they are examined into the last atom. This not 3,000 years ago. This not seeing of anything is another name for no birth and not for birth. This, Mahamati, is the nature of impermanency that is no birth, and as this is not understood, all the philosophers cherish the view of impermanency that is based on birth. Further, so he was dropping a little nugget of wisdom saying, if you ultimately look into the construction of everything, you will find that there is nothing there that abides. Everything is constantly in a state of change or evolution or arising, abiding, and dissolution, right? Dissolution. From what? It's the only word that you don't see him identify is energy. Further, Mahamati, by the conception of impermanency as objective existence is meant that there is a discrimination in the philosopher's own mind as to that which is not permanent and that which is not impermanent. So they're indicating a mental process, but they're still identifying that mental process as a recognition of the physical world instead of the mind creating its own identification of what is in the physical world. Do you see the difference? It's quite large if you consider Buddhism and what it teaches. But it might seem very tiny and subtle to the uninitiated, right? Or what Shakyamuni would call the ignorant. Which doesn't mean they're stupid, it just means they don't know. What is the sense of this? He says, it means that there is a thing called impermanency, which in itself is not subject to destruction. So impermanency is permanent. Right? That's a good one. But whose working there is the disappearance of all things, except impermanency, I suppose. And if not for impermanency, there would be no disappearance of all things. So it's impermanency's fault. That great field energy god of impermanence, yeah? It is like a stick or a stone or like a hammer breaking other things to pieces while itself remains unbroken. This is the philosopher's meaning, but as we actually see things about us, there is no such mutual differentiation which compels us to say that here is impermanency the cause, and there is the disappearance of all things as the effect. There is no such differentiation of cause and effect, and we cannot say here is impermanency as cause and there is effect. When there is thus no differentiation of cause and effect, all things are permanent since no cause exists to render them otherwise. It's just a word salad saying exactly what I was saying earlier. By inferring that there is a process of impermanency, then impermanency becomes a permanent thing, and therefore, by reference, everything is permanent, just changing in form by virtue of this hammer of impermanency. It's a very convoluted way of, but this is philosophers. They're really good at words. Mahamati, as to the disappearance of all things, there is a cause, but it is not in the understanding of the ignorant and simple-minded. When the cause is of a dissimilar nature, the same effect is not produced. In case it does, the impermanency of all things is an example of dissimilar effect, and there is no distinction between cause and effect, but the distinction between cause and effect is observed in them. If there is an objective existence to be known as impermanence, it will be characterized with the nature of an effect-producing cause, and there will be one entity contained in all things. When the notion is cherished of a cause-producing effect, this means that impermanence, the cause, is impermanent because it partakes of the nature of the effect, which is impermanent. All things, then, are not to be regarded as impermanent, but as permanent. Yes, he's quoting the philosophers quite well, because we all got lost in that. This is something we see throughout Shakyamuni's teachings, this and Nichiren as well. This and Nagarjuna, Dendai, they have this gift for penetrating logistic constructions of words that obviate the ridiculousness of the construction of words. But for some people, it doesn't seem so ridiculous. It's very mesmerizing. Wow, yeah, impermanence is a permanent thing. I don't see any problem with thinking that way. If impermanency, as a cause, resides within all things, it will come under the three divisions of time. Right? If impermanence is a physical attribute of every physical thing, then there's a past, present, and future impermanence, right? It's just another characteristic, another, like blue or red or yellow, impermanent. Okay. It passes away together with things past. Its future is not yet here, as things of the future are still unborn. In the present, it breaks up together with things of the present, because everything is constitute of all the elements, including impermanency. So, form, or matter, he goes on, results from the combination and variation of the elements, right? All these different atoms, molecules, so on and so forth. As the primary elements and the secondary elements are neither different nor not different, they are by nature not subject to destruction because, according to the philosophers, the elements are indestructible. So with this kind of thinking, the universe just appeared fully formed of all the atoms just assembling in various ways, along with the atom of impermanency. Philosophers tend to stay away from that depth of analysis, don't they? But Mahamati, it is an established fact that the entire triple world, with its elements primary and secondary, is born, abides, and disappears. Everything we witness in life is a process of becoming, existing, and dissolving. Everything has this arc over time-space. It's just a manifestation. And the moment it manifests, like a spark, it starts to extinguish and then disappears. This is the nature of life. All of it. The attachment part is our mind making permanent those things we experience. And that's why we're stressed out and anxious about everything, instead of just participating with it every moment. We want to hang on to it, right? How did the philosophers conceive a separate existence of impermanency, which is independent of the elements primary and secondary, while the elements themselves are neither set in motion nor destroyed because they cling to the notion of self-nature as eternally unchangeable? Ego. And once they established this magical mentation of existence, of identity, of ego, this is where follows the idea of eternity as a mental construct, a soul, somehow a bag of Bob, a box of Betty, going through lifetime after lifetime. Oh my God, the story gets incredibly complex and stupid. The conception of impermanency as existing in the first origination, which ceases to continue, is not tenable for three reasons. The elements cannot produce one another because each has its self-nature different from the others. Right? An atom of hydrogen, unless it goes through many changes, cannot become an item of gold, an atom of gold. An atom of gold is not an atom of hydrogen. It cannot be, will never be. Other reactions, other interreactions need to take place for a new formation to then create a new form, not born, but just a constant metamorphose and evolution, forms of energy amalgamating, coming apart. Each individual one cannot produce itself because there is no differentiation in it. Once an atom of hydrogen becomes an atom of hydrogen, it doesn't look around and go, let me clone myself. No, a separate formation of energies comes together to make yet another atom of hydrogen, right? You buy a car and you have a double car garage. Do you expect to go to sleep at night and wake up in the morning and have two? Because it's a double car garage, it will somehow duplicate itself to fill the garage? Do you see how nonsensical that thinking is? The mutually separated origination of the elements is impossible because there is no correspondence between the two. Hence the conclusion that the conception of origination impermanency, it's untenable. How can something originate and be impermanent? How do they do that? How can it be both things at once? By the conception of the impermanency in consideration of changes taking place in external form is meant that the elements, primary and secondary, are not subject to dissolution. Right? So when the hydrogen atom combines with two oxygen atoms, you get water, a molecule of water. But the water will never go away because ultimately the hydrogen and the oxygen will never disappear. But we know that's not true, right? The fact that we know what an atom is constituent of, ultimately energy, but even in the physical world, right? We know that that's not true. What is known as dissolution, Mahamati, even when closely examined until atoms are reached, is not the destruction of the elements primary and secondary, but of their external forms whereby the elements assume different appearances as short or long. But in fact, nothing is destroyed in the elemental atoms as far as energy, the construct of the atoms. What is seen as ceased to exist is the external formations of the elements. There's no more water. Well, it's because water was a construct of other atoms, which are also constructs of and you get to energy, yeah? This view is cherished by the Sankhya school, consider themselves quite intellectual. By the impermanency of external shapes is meant the impermanency of form, rupa. What is impermanent is thus the external shape and not the elements. If the elements themselves are impermanent, all our everyday experiences come to naught. We're getting on to something here. This is cherishing the view of the Lokayatika, according to which all things are reducible to mere words, because their self-nature is never seen as born. So existence consists of classifications, words. Identification is existence to the Lokayativa. They side-railed. They didn't get the central meaning of Buddhism. By the impermanency of changes is meant the changing of forms and not the changing of the elements themselves as seen in various ornamental articles of gold, which assume various forms. While there is no disappearance in the nature of gold, the ornamental articles variously change in form. Again, that's not impermanency, that's just changes in form, yeah? These and other views of impermanency as changes are discriminated variously by the philosophers, as is here described. Fire may burn all the elements, but their self-nature can never be burned. When each goes asunder by itself, there is the destruction of what constitutes the elements primary and secondary. However, Mahamati, I am neither for permanency nor for impermanency, certainly not in those realms of thought. Because in Buddhism, impermanency is just a word to label the fact that everything is empty. It's not a state of becoming. Impermanency is a label Shakyamuni is putting on the fact that all of what we conceive in the world is our mind's experience of it. And that is impermanent. That is temporary. That is ephemeral. That is happening as a construction of mentation. And that because we're in control of that factory of reality, we can alter the way it perceives and experiences. This is the core of Buddhism. We're not trying to alter the universe. We're trying to alter the universe in our mind. Why? For these reasons, external objects are not admitted. That identification process is shut down. We experience things in the moment-to-moment instantiation of life, everything. Without identification, without creating ego relations with, this is what makes room for Buddhist compassion. Because when that separation happens, our engagement, the nature of our relationship with samsara, becomes one of great compassion. Wanting everything and everyone and all sentient minds to perceive the amazing aspect of life, which is the mind, rather than its identifications, its possessions. What a tremendous shift, yeah? The triple world is taught as not being anything else but the mind itself. Past, present, and future, that's your mind creating that relationship, hanging on to experiences past, rather than spending time in the moment experiencing, we keep regurgitating things we've seen before. This is why in the fountain analogy, when 10 people go by the fountain and then they recount the fountain, if they even saw it, are completely mired in their experience of previous things. They've imposed, their mind has shut out new experiences because of its constant cataloging of the warehouse, the database. And so you miss what's happening right in front of your nose constantly. This is why it's called awakening. Do you see? Multiplicities of external existences are not accepted. Dragging along that bag of past impressions is blinding us. There is no rising of the elements, nor their disappearance, nor their continuation, nor their differentiation. That's all mentation. There are no such things as the elements primary and secondary because of the discrimination there evolved the dualistic indications of perceived and perceiving. When it is recognized that because of discrimination there is a duality, the discussion concerning the existence and non-existence of the external world ceases because the mind only is understood. The experience being moment to moment. There's no need to worry about destruction or creation, because everything is happening moment to moment. This is where life is. not back there. That's gone. That's not real. See, this is the fallacy of materialism. By identifying things, labeling things, we make them real in the sense that they forever are there and owned, building that house of cards of ego. Discrimination rises from discriminating a world of effect-producing works. No discrimination takes place when this world is not recognized. When you fully get into the stream of life, could you imagine, it's a poor analogy, but I'm going to try it anyway. Have you ever been in a kayak? Not a canoe, a kayak, or even a canoe. And gone down some really rough waters, rapids. Everybody knows what rapids are, right? When the river narrows and there's a bunch of rocks and outgrowths, and the water then speeds up because it's negotiating its path around all these obstacles, and there rises and little waterfalls and eddies and swirls, and it's very dangerous. And you, being in a rudderless little kayak, going along with the flow of the river, find yourself in these rapids, tossing around. Let me suggest to you, even if you've never done it, that after you're in the rapids for 30 seconds, a minute, 10 minutes, oh my gosh, 10 minutes, are you really thinking about that first rock you passed, or the 40th, or the eddy you came out of? Or is all your attention on, yikes, this moment? Just trying to react as quickly as you can to survive? Are you really pondering? What is that small rock on the left when I passed the 57th and the 58th and I went over that? Really? Is that what you're thinking? I'm curious. So this is what he's saying. Once you understand the nature of life, it's not even a thought to focus on, to reach into, to drag along the past, because there's nothing there. What there is there is the mental construction of permanence. But once you know better, then why am I, what is that? That's, bye, here I am. Wow, look at this life. It's quite a shift, yeah? Then a man ceases to cherish the discrimination of existence and non-existence, which rises out of his own mind. He sees that things either of this world or of a higher world or of the highest are not to be described as permanent or impermanent, because he does not understand the truth that there is nothing in the world but what is seen of the mind itself, the experience of being. That's the only thing that's real. As the meaning of discrimination is not understood by all the philosophers who have fallen into wrong ideas of dualism and who are people of no spiritual attainment, impermanency comes up to them as a subject for discussion. Mahamati, the triple aspect of all things as distinguished as of this world, of a higher world, and of the highest, is the outcome of word discrimination, labeling. But this is not understood by the ignorant and the simple-minded, so it is said. By the deluded philosophers, the notion of impermanency is discriminated as origination, cessation, as transformation of external forms, as an independent existence, as form. There is no destruction of things. The elements abide forever as regards their self-essence, immersed in varieties of views. The philosophers discriminate impermanency. To these philosophers, there is no destruction, no birth. The elements are permanent as regards their self-essence. Whoever discriminates impermanency, this is the position of the philosophers. According to the Buddha, there is nothing in the world but the mind itself, and all that is of duality has its rise from the mind and is seen as perceived and perceiving. An ego soul and what belongs to it, they exist not. The abode and realm of Brahma, etc., I declare all to be of mind only. Outside mind only, Brahma, etc., are not attainable. This ends the third chapter on impermanency. Now, I can hear you people typing, or thinking of typing, or maybe tilting your head. Did he just say? I think, first of all, we have to admit this is a translation. Many languages and cultures removed from Shakyamuni's actual oral sermon. So be clear on that. Secondly, I think it's very important to understand that we can't take like those last few words and make of them the entire lesson. You have to read those words in the context of all the thousands of words we've already read and discussed and listened to, with the understanding that what Shakyamuni is describing of mind only is our sentient mind in samsara voraciously collecting data and identifying that that data is the very fundament of our illusion that keeps us from experiencing this life as it is happening. We tend to set our entire sentient mind to task on analyzing the past. We tell ourselves we're trying to figure out the future, but that's a lie. Because everything we consider about the future is based solely on the past, and not the past as is, but the past as mentated. This is over and over again, Shakyamuni hammering on Mahamati, his students, his collective student body, that our thoughts are constantly not hinged on, fully attached to, what was the word? Entangled in what you might call memory. This idea, this database I keep talking about, the warehouse of data that we think that's life. No, it is not. That's a spark that's long extinguished. The life is happening now. And if you get involved in the being of life, then all of your stresses and anxiety about the damn warehouse are meaningless. The philosophers, they're just inventory, catalog makers, you know, warehouse managers. I hope that's become clear. We are now going to start, not now, but in the next video, Chapter 4. Yes, finally we've arrived at Chapter 4. I look forward to diving into Chapter 4 with you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for liking and subscribing. It means so much to the expansion of this Sangha to get us in the search results for more people on YouTube. So please don't forget to subscribe. If it's helpful, hit the notification bell. I do these practically every day, sometimes twice a day. So just get the habit of coming here if you need, or the podcasts, which are I do on the same day I post the audio version, or I shouldn't say version, but it's just the audio capture from these videos. So you can listen to them. It might be easier than the distraction of watching, yeah. And you know, we're not only on YouTube, I speak of us as a Sangha, but also on Patreon, where you have an option, not a necessity, but an option to donate through the engine of Patreon. Makes it easy. Or go directly to PayPal, it's your choice. All of those donations, and you patrons out there, you're amazing. So thank you. Thank you so much. Totally grateful for all of you. I can't wait till we dive into chapter 4 together. Until then, please take care of your health. Be kind to yourself. What the heck? Why not? Yeah? Okay. All right. I'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye for now.